Welcome to Lessons in Tanya, Chapter 26. We are so excited to bring you into another deep dive, really getting into the profound wisdom from this foundational text.
Absolutely. And in our previous discussions, we've really unpacked some quite revolutionary ideas.
Yeah, like that core message that serving the divine, you know, cultivating that deep connection, feeling true love and awe, it's actually accessible for everyone.
Exactly. It's not just for, you know, spiritual giants or mystics of old. It's for every single person.
And that accessibility we found comes either from really meditating on the divine's greatness, that intellectual path that sparks the soul.
Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, by tapping into that innate, sometimes buried love for the divine that's already inside us, that hidden love which naturally brings all with it.
Right. But look, anyone who's actually tried to walk this path knows it's not always smooth sailing. You hit roadblocks.
Oh, definitely.
And chapter 26, which is our focus today, it really zeroes in on one of the toughest, most common obstacles. That feeling of sadness or just dullness of heart.
Yes, that heavy feeling.
You know what I mean? When your spirit feels sluggish, unresponsive, like your heart's turned to stone almost, it makes it so hard to feel anything. Spiritual love, reverence, even simple joy.
It really does. It's like trying to hear beautiful music through thick earmuffs. The signal just doesn't get through properly.
Exactly.
And what's so valuable about this chapter is that it doesn't just point out the problem. It gives us incredibly clear, actionable strategies, not just to overcome this spiritual lethargy, but to actually transform it.
Okay, transform it. How?
Well, before getting into the specifics of sadness itself, the Alter Rebbe, the author of Tanya, he lays down what he calls a cardinal principle, a really fundamental truth for any spiritual progress.
A cardinal principle sounds important.
It is.
Yeah.
And the way he illustrates it is just brilliant.
Yeah.
A really vivid, relatable analogy, I promise, is one that'll stick with you. It completely reframes how we think about inner struggle and spiritual victory.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Let's get into this analogy then. What is it?
So the Alter Rebbe paints this picture. Imagine two people wrestling, a proper match.
Okay, locked in combat.
Exactly. Intense struggle, each one trying with everything they've got to overpower the other, pin them down. You know, a real primal contest of strength, will, agility.
Got it. Standard wrestling match. So what's the twist?
Here's the crucial insight. If one of those wrestlers is lazy, sluggish, moving like they're stuck in mud, heavy, no spark,
yeah,
they're going to lose.
Yeah.
Easily. They'll just fall. And here's the kicker. This happens even if that lazy wrestler is actually physically stronger than their opponent.
Wait, really? Even if they're stronger?
Even if they're stronger. Just think about that. We usually assume raw power, more muscle, guarantees the win.
Right. Stronger person wins.
But the Alter Rebbe points out that their laziness, their sluggishness, it literally stops them from using that strength effectively. It prevents the strength from even showing up when it counts.
So the power is there, but it's dormant, ineffective.
Precisely. It's like having a supercar engine, but the transmission is shot. All that horsepower is useless if you can't get it to the wheels. Their lack of agility, of quickness, negates their inherent power.
Wow, that really changes things. So victory isn't just about the strength you have, but how you actually mobilize it.
Exactly. Application is key. Sluggishness is this massive self-imposed handicap. It cancels out even a clear advantage in raw power.
It implies strength isn't static, it's dynamic. It needs activation.
Perfectly put. It challenges our whole intuition about strength. We think capability, potential. But the Alter Rebbe introduces this vital element of alacrity, spiritual agility, responsiveness. A heavy heart, he shows, can completely neutralize superior inner strength.
It's a deep lesson then, not just for wrestling, but for, well, for our inner battles.
That's exactly where he takes it. This principle applies precisely to our internal spiritual struggle, the conquest of our less noble inclinations.
Okay, so let's make that connection. Because we learned in earlier chapters that our good nature, our divine soul, it's really inherently much stronger than our sort of animalistic side, our negative inclination.
Yes, the idea that even a little light dispels much darkness.
Right. So on paper, it feels like the good side should always win, easily, like overwhelmingly. Why doesn't it always feel that way?
That's the paradox, isn't it? You'd think the light would just dominate. But the Alter Rebbe states very clearly, despite this built-in superior strength of goodness within us, it is impossible to conquer our lower inclinations if we approach the fight with laziness and sluggishness.
Impossible, even with the stronger muscle.
Impossible. And where did these states come from? He traces them directly back to sadness, and that stone-like dullness of the heart.
So the sadness isn't just a feeling, it's an active block.
Exactly. It's not just that they feel bad. They actively prevent our spiritual strength, our inner light, from even manifesting. They cloud our judgment, dull our spiritual senses, paralyze our will. It makes us spiritually inert.
Like trying to run that race with lead weights on or wrestling on that mat covered in molasses.
Perfect analogies. Your strength might be there, but you physically can't move with the necessary speed or agility to bring it to bear. Sadness and dullness do that to our spiritual muscles.
So the only way out, the only path to victory in this inner wrestling match is through what he calls alacrity.
Yes, alacrity.
And this alacrity, he says, comes directly from joy and from having an open, responsive heart, a heart totally free from worldly worry and sadness.
That's the source. Joy and an open heart. Alacrity isn't just about being fast. It's a state of being. Mm. The heart is receptive, clear, vibrant. There's a willingness, an eagerness, an unburdened spirit that lets spiritual energy flow freely.
Like an open channel.
Precisely. Oh. When the heart is heavy with sadness or worry, that channel gets blocked, constricted. The divine light, our innate strength, it's still there, inside us. But it just can't get through effectively.
But joy opens it up.
Joy opens it wide, makes the heart responsive, agile, alive. It's the essential lubricant for spiritual movement. It lets our inherent strength translate into real, successful action.
Okay, this makes the case for joy and alacrity incredibly strong. But then you have that verse, in every sadness there will be profit, from Proverbs.
Yes, the apparent contradiction.
Right. It sounds like sadness actually has some kind of benefit, some virtue in itself. How does that square with everything we just said about it being this huge spiritual obstacle?
It's a fantastic question, and the Alter Rebbe provides a crucial clarification. It hinges on the exact wording. There will be profit.
Okay, will be. Future tense.
Exactly. It subtly implies that sadness itself isn't the profit.
Yeah.
It has no inherent virtue. Rather, the profit is an advantage that will ultimately be derived from it.
So sadness is a means, not an end. A catalyst.
Precisely. It's not the destination you seek, but maybe a necessary, if unpleasant, step on the path to something much greater, like breaking up hard soil before you can plant seeds. The breaking isn't the goal. The harvest is.
That makes more sense. So if sadness isn't the goal itself, what is this profit? What's the advantage it leads to? It must be something significant.
It is. The profit, the Alter Rebbe explains, is the true joy in the divine that follows a very specific kind of sadness. And this is key. It's not just any old sadness.
Right, not just feeling down.
No, it's a genuine, justified sadness over one's spiritual missteps, one's failings. It's characterized by bitterness of soul and a broken heart, a deep, honest self-assessment.
Okay, like a real moment of truth with oneself.
Yes, but crucially, it has to happen at specific, appropriate times. It shouldn't be a constant, lingering, paralyzing state. Think of it like focused spiritual surgery. Not a chronic illness.
Got it. A designated time for feeling that.
Yeah.
That brokenness.
And that specific sadness serves to clear the path, to break down internal spiritual barriers.
Mm.
The deep, abiding joy that comes after that clearing process, that's the real profit, the enduring benefit.
So it's a two-step process, the necessary breaking, then the resulting joy. How does that actually work? What's the spiritual mechanism? How does that specific sadness lead to joy?
Well, through this genuine, focused sadness, this true brokenness of heart, something profound happens internally. The spirit of impurity, those negative forces or inclinations that pull us away from the divine, gets broken, shattered, even. And also, that metaphorical iron wall that our mistakes can build up, separating us from our source, that gets broken down too.
An iron wall.
It's a powerful image. An ancient mystical text commenting on the verse, "A broken spirit, a broken heart, you will not despise." Explain it this way. A broken spirit of the negative forces is brought about by means of a broken heart.
Wow. So our broken heart actually breaks the negative forces.
In a sense, yes. That genuine remorse, that acknowledgement of where we've gone wrong, creates an opening, a vulnerability in those spiritual barriers, allowing them to crumble.
I see. So when those barriers break down the impurity, the wall, it clears the way. It creates the space.
Exactly. It creates the necessary space, almost like a spiritual vacuum, for the individual to then fully experience the joy mentioned in those beautiful verses from Psalms. Make me hear joy and gladness.
Restore to me the joy of your salvation.
Precisely. The sadness, by breaking down the negative, literally makes room for a higher, more potent joy to rush in and fill that void.
That's incredible. So the sadness itself isn't the point at all. Its entire value, its sole purpose, is to pave the way for a deeper, more lasting joy.
You've got it. It's a means to an end, a tool for purification, but absolutely not a state to cultivate or linger in for its own sake.
This distinction feels really critical. Okay, so now, what about the quality of this joy that follows the sadness? Because the Alter Rebbe seems to suggest it's actually better, superior to joy that doesn't have that kind of prelude.
Yes, he does. He even points to a practice instituted by Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, a major figure in mystical thought.
The renowned mystic, right?
Yes. He introduced a custom. After a specific midnight prayer, one that often involves deep reflection on spiritual failings, you recite a particular psalm before you go back to studying sacred texts.
Interesting. Why that specific order? Psalm, after the remorse, before the study.
And the reason given is profound, yet simple. It's precisely in order that one should study with the true joy in the divine that succeeds the remorse of that midnight prayer.
So you don't just push the sadness aside, you integrate it. It fuels the joy.
Exactly. The sadness, the genuine remorse, isn't discarded. It becomes part of the process, leading to a higher, more engaged, more appreciative form of study afterwards. It's like deeply cleansing yourself before receiving something precious. It prepares the heart.
And this leads to that really profound idea that this joy born from that crucible of sadness is actually better quality joy.
Yes, higher quality. It's compared to the unique quality of light which follows darkness.
That's more than just a nice metaphor, isn't it?
It's a deep truth about experience. The classic mystical commentary on King Solomon's observation that wisdom surpasses foolishness as light surpasses darkness. It asks, is that really so obvious? Of course, light is better than dark.
Right. It seems self-evident.
But the deeper meaning revealed is this. Just as we only truly appreciate light after experiencing darkness and fully value wisdom after encountering foolishness, so too, that earlier sadness, that genuine moment of brokenness and remorse, it actually adds strength and depth to the joy that comes after. It makes the joy resonate more deeply, feel more precious, more enduring.
So the prior darkness makes the subsequent light brighter, more meaningful.
Precisely. It's not just happiness. It's a joy forged in self-awareness and repentance. That's the ultimate profit, the enhancement and elevation of the joy that follows.
This really clarifies things. Sadness has a specific time-bound role, break barriers, enhance joy, but the core message is unwavering. Sadness itself is a hindrance to service.
Absolutely. A temporary tool, a stepping stone, never a place to live. You use it to get to the light. You don't stay in the shadow.
And the emphasis on joy in service is just immense.
It's paramount. Scripture explicitly states, because you did not serve the divine, your superior, with joy. And that verse comes right before descriptions of really serious negative consequences.
So it's not just preferred, it's required.
It underscores that joy isn't just a nice-to-have bonus. It's fundamental, essential for a real effective connection. Without that alacrity, that joy, our spiritual potential just can't fully manifest.
And Rabbi Yitzhak Luria's take on this verse is mind-blowing. It's not just about having joy, but serving with a joy greater than the joy you'd get from having everything, abundance of everything.
Yes. Think about that. The joy from connecting with the divine should outweigh the greatest possible material pleasure, the biggest worldly success, any physical comfort imaginable. It sets the bar incredibly high.
It completely redefines what true happiness even means. It's on a totally different level.
It really does. It stresses the immense importance of joy. It's not passive. It's something you actively cultivate as a central pillar of your spiritual life.
Okay, so that covers the importance of joy and how to handle sadness related to spiritual failings. But what about, what about just life? The sadness from mundane stuff.
Ah, yes. The everyday worries.
Because let's face it, life throws curveballs. Worries about kids, health problems, job stress, money troubles. Just basic life stuff can cause real sadness and anxiety. How do we deal with that kind of heaviness?
It's a universal experience, for sure. And for these very common, very human worries, the sages offer what's called sound advice, a way to cleanse your heart from all that kind of sadness, all that worry about worldly things, even the big stuff.
Okay, sound advice sounds good. What is it? Is it just don't worry, be happy?
Not quite so simple. It's more radical. It stems from that well-known teaching. Just as one recites a blessing for good fortune, so must he also recite a blessing for misfortune.
Right. And my first thought is always, how? How can you bless something that feels awful?
It's a natural reaction. But the ancient commentaries clarify it doesn't mean saying the exact same blessing or feeling the exact same way. For obvious good, you bless the one who is good and does good. For apparent misfortune, you bless the true judge, acknowledging divine wisdom.
Okay, different blessings. But still, joy.
Yes. The implication is you should accept misfortune with joy, similar to the joy you feel with revealed obvious good. And the reason, the underlying belief, the deep conviction, is that even this is for the good.
Even when it really, really doesn't look like it.
Even then. The only reason it appears bad is because the goodness is hidden. It's not visible to our limited mortal eyes. We're just seeing the surface layer, not the deeper reality unfolding.
So it's not denying the pain, but reframing the entire event, believing there's a hidden goodness.
Exactly. A profound reframe. And if it's truly for the good, even when hidden, where does this hidden good come from? What's its source?
Good question. Where does it come from?
It comes from what's called the hidden spiritual world. This is understood as a higher, more sublime spiritual realm than the revealed spiritual world, which is the source of obvious apparent good.
Hidden world versus revealed world. Like an underground spring versus an open river.
That's a great analogy. Revealed good is like that clear river, easy to see, easy to access, flowing from a more manifest aspect of the divine. Hidden good is like that deep spring, pure, powerful, but you might need to dig for it, break through some rock. It originates from a higher, more concealed aspect of the divine. Ancient wisdom uses the symbolic letters of the divine name to illustrate this. The revealed good comes from the lower, more manifest letters. The hidden good comes from the higher, more abstract letters.
Higher letters, hidden good. Lower letters, revealed good.
Right. And this connects to scripture too. Think about the verse, happy is the man whom you, divine, using the higher letters, chasten. It speaks of suffering, chastening, yet connects it directly to those higher, hidden divine aspects.
So the suffering itself originates from a higher source.
Indicating that its source is elevated. Sublime. It comes from a deeper layer of divine wisdom and goodness that we can immediately perceive. So these misfortunes aren't just blessings in disguise. They actually represent an even higher level of good, precisely because they flow from this more sublime, hidden world.
Wow, that turns everything on its head. What looks like a setback is actually tapping into a higher source of good.
Potentially, yes. It's an invitation to connect on a deeper level. And those who can do this, who can genuinely rejoice even in affliction because they perceive this hidden good, the sages have a special description for them.
Oh, what's that?
They are the ones referred to in the verse, those who love him shall be as the sun when it comes out in its might.
Lovers of the divine. Why that connection? Rejoicing in affliction makes you a lover of the divine. How does that work?
It's explained through this principle of measure for measure, spiritual reciprocity. Their joy in affliction isn't about liking pain. It comes because they prioritize nearness to the divine above everything else in this world. Like the verse says, for your loving kindness is better than life.
So connection to the divine is the ultimate value for them, more than comfort, success, even life itself.
Exactly. And this nearness to the divine is said to be infinitely greater, more sublime in that hidden spiritual world. That's where the concealment of his power is lodged, where the Most High abides in secrecy.
So the hidden world, source of apparent misfortune, actually holds a deeper divine presence.
A more intense revelation, yes, though concealed in this world. So because these individuals look past the external appearances, beyond the veil of misfortune, and focused on that deeper divine reality concealed within it, they are rewarded accordingly in the world to come.
And the reward is?
Simply breathtaking. The divine casts off the veils and reveals himself in his full glory, symbolized by the sun emerging in its might.
The sun coming out. A complete reversal. The hidden becomes fully revealed.
Completely. The divine essence itself, sometimes compared to the blinding sun, emerges from the shield, the concealment that makes divine light bearable in this world. For these individuals and the world to come, that shield is removed. The divine essence shines forth in its full, unmitigated glory, directly experienced.
So the hidden world they tapped into through faith amidst suffering becomes the revealed reality for them later.
Precisely. What is now the hidden spiritual world will then be revealed in intense glory to those who found refuge and meaning even in the shade of misfortune here. They saw beyond the darkness. This perspective transforms suffering from something to dread into, potentially, an opportunity for profound spiritual ascent and ultimate revelation.
That is just incredibly powerful. It reframes difficulty entirely. Okay, so that's mundane sadness. Now let's pivot back to the other kind. Sadness connected with heavenly matters.
Right. Feelings of spiritual inadequacy, regret, disconnect, feeling overwhelmed by it all.
How is this type of sadness treated?
Very differently. The Alter Rebbe is quite firm. One must find ways to actively free oneself from this kind of spiritual sadness, especially, he stresses, during times of actual divine service study, prayer. Joy and gladness are essential then. Dwelling on inadequacy at those moments is counterproductive.
It kills the alacrity we talked about.
Exactly. But here's where it gets really subtle and kind of insidious.
Yeah.
The Alter Rebbe points out a tactic of the negative inclination. He says, even if you're busy with mundane things, work, business, whatever, if sadness or anxiety about spiritual matters suddenly descends on you then,
yeah,
it is certainly a trick of the evil inclination.
Certainly a trick. That's strong language. Why would the negative side want us to feel bad about spiritual failings, even if it's at the wrong time?
Because it's a setup. The motive is insidious. It saddens you, makes you feel guilty or inadequate about spiritual things, precisely to make you vulnerable later. It plays on human nature. We seek pleasure, we avoid pain.
Okay, how does that work?
If you're constantly distressed about your spiritual state, feeling like a failure, unable to find joy there, where are you going to seek relief?
Yeah.
Often, in physical gratification, lower desires, distractions, the negative side makes you feel bad spiritually to push you towards indulging physically. It whispers, see, you failed anyway. Might as well enjoy this.
It's a distraction and a temptation tactic rolled into one.
Exactly. And the proof, the Alter Rebbe suggests, is the timing. If this sadness were genuinely from a place of pure love or fear of the divine, wouldn't it hit hardest during prayer, during study, when you're actually trying to connect?
Yeah, that makes sense.
The fact that it often pops up during mundane activities is a telltale sign. It's not about genuine remorse leading to growth. It's about paralyzing your spiritual will, making you feel hopeless, and opening the door for other temptations. It wants to sap your alacrity.
So when that feeling hits that spiritual gloom, whether during prayer or just randomly during the day, what's the strategy? How do we get out of that trap?
The advice is very direct, almost startlingly practical. The Alter Rebbe says, basically, tell yourself, now is not the proper time for genuine sadness, nor even for worry over grave sins.
Just postpone it.
Not ignore it, but postpone the feeling, the dwelling. The strategy is to set aside specific opportune times when your mind is calm and focused deliberately for reflection on the greatness of the divine against whom he has sinned.
Okay, scheduled introspection.
Right. Focused contemplation that leads to true living remorse and bitterness. An active feeling of regret that motivates change, not that paralyzing depression. It's a contained, purposeful act, often done in solitude.
So you schedule the deep reflection, feel the genuine remorse then, but then what? You can't stay there.
Exactly. And this is the crucial, almost radical next step. Immediately after experiencing that broken heart during those appointed times, the Alter Rebbe says he should completely remove the sorrow from his heart.
Completely remove it, just like that. That sounds hard.
It is hard, but it's made possible through a necessary act of profound faith. You must believe with perfect faith that the divine has erased his sin and that he pardons abundantly.
Perfect faith and forgiveness.
Absolute, unwavering conviction. Trusting that even if you've messed up repeatedly, even the same mistake over and over, the divine forgives readily, completely.
Yeah.
Like it was the first time. This is totally unlike human forgiveness, which often wears thin.
Divine forgiveness is boundless.
Boundless, immediate, and complete for those who truly regret and resolve to change. And this knowledge, this deep belief in forgiveness, that is the true joy in the divine that follows the sadness.
Ah, it comes full circle.
It does. It fulfills that principle. The profit of the scheduled sadness lies entirely in the profound joy of knowing you are forgiven and free to move forward. It's the ultimate liberation from spiritual despair. It allows alacrity and joyful service to blossom again.
So engage in focused remorse at the right time, then immediately shift to absolute faith and forgiveness. That transforms the whole experience.
It empowers you. Shed the weight of the past, move forward with lightness, with alacrity, ready for joyful service again.
Wow, what an incredible roadmap through chapter 26. Just to recap the core message.
Yeah.
It really boils down to the absolute necessity of alacrity and joy for any kind of spiritual progress.
Right. Being spiritually agile, present, engaged, not sluggish or weighed down, whether it's overcoming inner challenges or just in our daily service.
And we got that incredibly nuanced view of sadness, how it can be a prophet, but only as a catalyst, a specific tool to lead to a much deeper joy.
And that crucial difference. Mundane sadness often hides a higher good, while spiritual sadness, especially at the wrong times, is frequently a trap from the negative inclination.
The practical tools are so key. Actively cultivating joy, even in misfortune, by looking for that hidden divine good, and handling spiritual sadness, not by wallowing, but by scheduling focused remorse, followed immediately by rock-solid faith in divine forgiveness.
These aren't just nice ideas. They're really precise, transformative instructions.
Yeah.
A way to live with more purpose, more connection, more vibrancy.
Absolutely. This deep dive really gives us, and hopefully you, our listener, concrete strategies to keep that heart joyful and agile even when life gets tough.
Right.
It's about reframing adversity, understanding the dynamics of the inner struggle.
It really is empowering. These principles can genuinely transform how anyone experiences life and their connection to the divine, wherever they are on their journey. It offers a path to inner freedom, constant growth.
So as we wrap up this really rich discussion, here's a final thought to ponder. Considering this deep link between joy and real spiritual engagement, how might consciously looking for that hidden good in what seems like misfortune actually change your experience, your relationship with the divine?
Yeah, what small step could you take, maybe even today, to bring a little more alacrity, a bit more joy into your own journey? Perhaps by trying to find that hidden spring, even when the ground feels dry.